Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. All right. Today's guest is Donna Griffith, a world-renowned corporate storyteller and pitch alchemist. She's worked with over 1,000 startups, Fortune 500 companies, and leading investors across 30 countries. She's helped them raise over $1 billion in transforming complex ideas, I would say sometimes boring ideas, into clear and compelling narratives that win funding, customers, and markets. She is the author of Sticking to My Story, the Alchemy of Storytelling for Startups. Donna, welcome to Experience Focused Leaders.
Great to be here, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm so fired up to meet a fellow storytelling guru. We are very kind of narrow understanding of storytelling, more focused on the digital. But one of the things that we pride ourselves is picking the best ideas from practitioners like you and bringing them into our platform. And I think our part of that is platform is becoming the podcast. So just very excited to learn. I wanted to kick off with one of the quotes from your book, and then maybe we could extrapolate from there. Does that sound like a plan? All right.
Sounds fabulous.
My sincere belief is that everyone has a story that is unique and compelling. There are no boring stories, so I was wrong on that. There are merely layers and stacks of information piled up, obscuring the beauty of the story. I'm here to help the layers, peel the layers away and let startups polish their stories until they shine like the top of Chrysler building. So let's get
that's,
to the
that's
top.
That's a quote from Annie for anybody, you know, that grew up in Broadway music. So,
all right.
It's like the top of the Chrysler building. I know. But you know, it's funny because I wrote this about 3 years ago, and I'm always looking for, like, new metaphors will just emerge for me. Then I was thinking in layers. Since then, it's evolved into polishing diamonds. You know how the facets and everything is just kind of like, you look at a piece of coal, it doesn't look very shiny, but you can completely transform that. And that's truly, and one of the reasons I call myself a pitch alchemist and not just a pitch magician, which I kind of am as well, is that I'm already working with a great element. It's solid. But the minute you add storytelling to the mix, it transforms it into gold, into this other thing that's even more precious, because I work with so many startups that are so brilliant and so important, yet people can't see beyond the layers, beyond the dust, beyond the cobwebs, beyond the coal, beyond the dust, whatever it might be. And once we go through this polishing and the shining of it, it's like brilliance comes through and it's amazing. It really is. And it's such a satisfying moment too. It's like, oh, wow. I didn't realize how brilliant this could truly be.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up this the brilliance of the founder. So by the way, you worked with corporates in your previous in as well. So, but generally, the more complex, the more important the idea, and sometimes the smarter the people that came up with that idea, the more difficult it is for other people to actually understand it, engage with it, do something different because of it, right? Like buy it, for example. And it's just this paradox, right? And so this leaves the world poorer, because we are, you know, our brightest minds are kind of not able to get out of that minds into something that, you know, the people that are not experts in that field.
So true. So true. And sometimes I describe it as like, you know, founders, when they think about their message and their idea here, it is absolutely clear, brilliant, beautiful. They see it. And then somewhere between that and this, where it's brought up to the rest of the world, there's a disconnect, a missing circuit. And I'm there to just reconnect it. Like, I don't write their stories for them. I take all of the data and all of their experience and their stories and tie it all together and process it with this magical element of storytelling and bring it out. And I was just saying to my daughters the other day, it's Rosh Hashanah and we hosted 25 people. And
25 people,
Shana Tova. And I'm still wearing red for the apples because we're recording on the second, third, fourth day, whatever. It never ends. It never ends. So I was, you know, looking at the ingredients. I was making this beautiful pot of pomegranate braised short ribs. And there was like a package of raw meat and a bottle of 100% pomegranate juice and, you know, a bunch of little veggies I had cut up, at least I cut them up, and some seasoning and beef stock in its little jar waiting to be made into stock. And I thought, you know, if my guests came over tonight and I just served them up a platter of these raw ingredients, I don't think they would have been as pleased with me as a hostess as I did when I spent several hours seasoning, searing, boiling, chopping, and putting it all together and then letting it cook. And then we had this beautiful dish that was just delicious. And that is exactly what happens with founders that come to me. They bring all these raw ingredients that are sort of discombobulated, certain things for the dessert are mixed in with the dinner and the appetizers all over the place. And when we separate it out and then cook it all as a meal, adding that magic ingredient. When it's cooking for me, it's love. When it's writing pitches, it's storytelling that's the magic ingredient. The experience is completely different. Same ingredients, completely different experience.
That's so wonderful. And so for the folks that are relate to users in the audience, we think of relate to as maybe your content is the meal and Donna will help you prepare it in an incredible way. But we could be maybe the table settings, the beautiful lights that you prepare, the silverware.
I'm not very good at plating. I'm good at cooking. I'm good at talking. Yeah. I'm good at doing a lot of things. Things with my hands, I'm less talented, which is fine because my father-in-law is an artist, Florence trained. So my daughters and husband have that talent. I'm cool giving that up. But, you know, we all have to excel at what we excel at. But yes, we do need it to look great as well as sound great.
Yeah. And I think there is the, when you were talking also about the cooking, I just remembered one of my favorite quotes from Steve Jobs, which is when he talked to a group of his designers and they said, "You guys baked a beautiful cake. But for frosting, you covered it with dog shit."
It's the opposite. People will take a pile of crap and sugarcoat it and put ribbons and bows on it, but it's still crap. But that's interesting.
So to me, it was interesting because, again, why I wrote that quote resonated with us is that kind of the ambiance of the experience of like when you enter the room, if it smells poorly or the settings are dirty, your spooks of forks are dirty,
it'll show
and it takes away from that Michelin whatever Florentine cooking
details,
experience.
Details count, and you know, I think from what I take from that from what he said is that, you know, because Apple is so design driven and everything being just flawless looking, simple, beautifully packaged, beautifully created, the Johnny Ivy way. And sometimes, again, I'll see a great deck, which the design is just, oh my God, my eyes bleed. And that can't work either. It has to be a blend. And design isn't just making it look pretty, decorating it with ribbons. Yeah. it's about elevating the message, because everything visual on a slide that we see, we ascribe meaning to.
That's right. That's right. And it's typically, it's the first thing that hits the eye, right? Mm-hmm. So that's saying that you never get a second chance to create a first impression.
Yes, yes, yes. I would not have posted my pan of delicious short ribs on Instagram. I don't have Instagram, but I wouldn't, because it tastes delicious. It just doesn't look, it doesn't look very good.
Looks
But
messy.
again, it's just a pan filled with chunks of meat with this beautifully glazed sauce, but it's going to look like, so there's no point. Now, again, if somebody can plate it and put like just one piece and then garnish it with the pomegranate seeds and a little, you know, scoop of my Robuchon mashed potatoes, and then it'll look as beautiful as it tastes. So, I mean, we can enjoy the experience. We're all sitting out in the yard. It was kind of dark. Nobody was looking. What it looked like, everyone was just ready to eat. But when you are presenting something visually, you have to consider that as well. How is it going to read? Because we start, like you said, with our eyes, and then it goes to our ears, which is the same center we process reading. People think reading is a visual thing. It is not. It's an auditory thing, because you and I both have English software that we know how to decode English.
That
I don't
is
know
very
how many
kind,
languages.
But I do not speak.
You don't have the English. Well, I don't
very
know
well.
how many other languages you speak. I'm guessing at least another two or three. And so you have that software that I don't have. So if I was to see, what's your native language?
Russian.
Russian. So if I see Russian, I can't even make out the alphabet because it's very different. So to me, I can say, oh, that's Russian. I can visualize that, but I can't decode it. So it stops at the visual layer. But if then I understand now AirPods will have simultaneous translation. That's not for reading, that's for listening. But if I'm listening to somebody in a Russian conversation, it'll automatically decode it for me. So that's interesting, because what happens is people load up their slides with text. And what people are seeing that are doing, because we've been trained in school that if something's up on the board, we'd better read the board, the whiteboard, the blackboard, whatever era you grew up in, we better read it. But what happens is you're canceling out hearing the person speak. So you're trying to speak, and your slides, not yours, of course, somebody else's, are filled with you know, bullets and paragraphs and things. There's no way they're reading and listening to you at the same time. Busy signal.
Yeah, well, and I think this is one of the reasons what I found it relate to is I kind of went back to some of my frustrations as a communicator, and I started at Microsoft with PowerPoint, obviously being, you know, on the Office team. So we obviously saw that. But interestingly, in consulting, when you join consulting, you write really thoughtful slides, but consulting slides tend to be not presenter slides as much. They're like basically
I see that at Stanford GSB all the time.
It's written books.
You can tell
books,
who came from McKinsey or from BCG.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Like right
it's
away.
Like it's in there. It's a, like not quite Tolstoy, but could be, you know, could be close enough, right? Like with some bullets, right? It's Tolstoy with
Tolstoy
bullets.
Written in its original language sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. And so and I was probably doing that. I don't remember, but I definitely remember. It was like I thought I was very smart. I was full of myself. This was even before Stanford. But as one partner said, this guy, you know, I was a consultant. I got to an MBA level job before the MBA. Is like, but he was kind of joking. I think Shevelenko thinks he's a partner, and I thought I was very smart, thinking that I just really understood everything and it was switched on. And for whatever reason, people were, you know, absorbing my ideas or buying into them. And so it kind of started opening up this realization that you can have the best ideas in the world, or what you think are the best ideas in the world. If you can't get them across, you can't get people excited about, you can't make them feel like they're their people's ideas, their ideas, right? Like you're shoving the information down the, it's a struggle.
And I'll quote another Silicon Valley great leader, Stuart Butterfield, Slack, and he was interviewed by Reid Hoffman. I guess Reid had asked him, you know, what's one piece of advice you would give to your younger self? And he said, focus on the storytelling, on convincing people, because if you can't do that, it doesn't matter how great your products are. And I always joke, you know, with when I give this workshop for companies that have come from Korea and Japan, Europe, anywhere that they come to Silicon Valley. And I say, you know, and when you're here, you should ask to be taken. We have a very, 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 very big graveyard of all the apps and technologies that didn't quite make it. And then they're like, oh, where can we sit? I'm like, I'm kidding, guys, because, you know, humor doesn't always, but you know, we want to see you succeed. We want to be able to say, oh my gosh, he was in my workshop. She was in my workshop way back when, and look at where they are now. And I think storytelling is a huge part of that. Because if you have wonderful products that sit on shelves or in your virtual inventory, what have you done? Nothing.
It
and
feels
that
like
can
it's a tragedy almost. Like
it is.
it's
Exactly.
goes
It's
like
a tragedy.
It's and I think this is why what you're doing is really pivotal, because, you know, let's imagine, like, and we've seen this. So the UN is in the news now, and President Trump was accusing UN of, you know, not doing enough to get things done. And so some people say, well, that's a Trump thing or whatnot. But regardless of your politics, there's actually some studies, both on UN and World Bank, that, you know, they produce a lot of content that nobody actually reads or does anything with. And
Or
so
they read it and I figure out how filled with absolute biased and ridiculous drivel is there. And some of the sources that they use are ridiculous. But I think they build on the fact that nobody's really going to read it. They're just
But
going to
it
look
feels like it, right? Like, and so, like, there was got to the point where I think the most popular, the most downloaded report by World Bank at some point was the one that said that nobody reads the World Bank reports. And so it kind of, it just creates this, perpetuates this.
I filled in a survey this morning, and like about the seven. Oh, by the way, this little fur ball. I'm doggy sitting. This is Lola. So if you see a little like fur ball pop up, you understand kind of what it
beautiful. As
But
Lola,
anyway, so
a very good
Lola.
listener.
Yes, Lola's got a lot to say right now. So what I am like. So the survey question, like number 17, was like many people fill out surveys and don't even read the questions. To prove you are, please mark answer three. And answer three was just like absolute, like nothing. But I'm like, how clever for them to see if this is a bot filling it out or an actual human that's doing it.
So how do we help? So, like, I think this is beyond just startups, right? Like, so the startups just happen to be at the forefront of trying to take new and complex and translate it. What do you see as the, like, biggest sins in storytelling? I think in your book, you talk about the first 30 seconds, the first impressions, but, like, what would you say some of the most common mistakes that are easily avoidable?
Oh, wow. Where do I even start? First of all, not having a story.
Okay.
Let's start with that.
Okay.
And I get so many decks that just are so like they go either straight into the solution and not the
Yeah.
problem. I'm going to let Lola out for a second while we continue pondering it.
Yeah.
And then second of all, so okay, when you don't have a personal story, a personal
Yeah.
narrative about how you came up with this idea and how it all started, you're missing a lot. You're really truly missing a whole opportunity to engage your investors, your potential investors, your potential clients, your potential partners in this whole like dialogue of what truly drove you to do this, to take this crazy journey. And it's fascinating because they can't argue with a personal narrative. I mean, they can, but most likely you can. If you're talking about a personal pain, a family pain, something that happened that showed you, oh my gosh, I need to do something about this and solve it, and you're not using it, to me, talk about tragedies. What a waste! Because stories stick. You do not walk away remembering the CAC, LTV, projected revenues for 2026. Nobody's going to remember that. They'll refer back, but they will remember the story of someone whose father was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in his 50s and nothing was helping bring his blood sugar levels down. So he went out to find something, a cure, even though it wasn't a cure, but found a much bigger problem addressing the whole population of chronic illnesses and started this multi-billion dollar company. And then when I, you know, so that was just his story that we told. And then a few years later, he asked me to work on their sales deck. And the sales deck didn't have the story. And I'm like, what? I go to the VP sales, like, what's going on here? Why aren't you telling the Ron and Rafael story? And they're like, oh, we get 15 minutes with Whole Foods. We don't have time for a story. And I'm like, guys, there's always time for a story.
There's always time for a story. So this
I don't
is
care
really
how long it is.
Yeah.
But then they told me something. It's just like, wait a second. They told me something amazing. VP sales, US director of sales, both also had fathers that were diagnosed in their 50s with type 2 diabetes. And I'm like, you guys are sitting on a storytelling gold mine. How are you not using this? Are you mad? And it's like, I look at this and it's like having, like somebody having a treasure chest of gold coins sitting in the corner of their house. And they're like, well, I don't know if I should really spend them. I don't know if I should really trade them in and get money. I'm like,
come on, yeah. But is it one story or it's multiple stories? There's a founder story, there's a future story.
Layered and rich. So there's a few different kinds of storytelling. First of all, the origin story. And you don't have to have a sick father in order to tell a good origin story. It could be a place you worked. It could be something in the world that is going on. Like, for example, I just finished working on the deck of a Series B company, and they're very, very big in cyber, but the whole focus of cyber now is moving to brands as well in the era of deep fakes and fraud and phishing, smishing, all these different things that are affecting CEO stories or you know, different things coming out. And it's very, very hard to protect. So the story that we told there is basically the story that all of us are seeing. We are seeing an explosion of AI-driven frauds and scams. And that's a story because we get it, because we've seen it. You can see, like, torn from the headlines, things that have happened. And that's a story too. So it could be just something that we're all experiencing, and it makes us go, oh my gosh, this really is a problem. This is really growing. So,
so you have to
story.
Either your origin or like something in the zeitgeist, something in the air
that
people
and
can
you can
personally
work
relate
with
to.
What's right now relevant. What's right now relevant could be Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce getting engaged and you not having some kind of way to address that in your influencer. I mean, that too is a missed opportunity. It's not the same as solving cybercrime or fraud, but there's an opportunity there. So it doesn't have to be a painkiller. It can also be a vitamin. Both work. Both will make you a lot of money. You just have to distinguish which story you're telling. Another story is the whole structure. So you mentioned my book. And in my book, I had to find the structure of showing people how to build out their decks, whether it's an investor deck or a sales deck. And then what I chose is to look at acts, like acts of a play. I'm a huge theater baby, grew up acting, studying theater, big shock there, right? And when I started researching for my book, again, no surprise, but a thrill, that one of the oldest ways of storytelling is theatrical writing, Greek tragedies, then Shakespeare, Chekhov, Moliere, and they wrote in acts, act one, act two, act three, act four. And it's very intentional, the way that it spreads out. And that is the same way Hollywood writes. There's about 8 different archetypal scripts that are written again and again and again. And by the way, I just had like this, as I was doing my cooking, I always find, like, I call it my cooking and dishes series. So I watched Hunting Wives on Netflix because it doesn't require a lot of concentration.
Right.
And I was just like hit with this, oh my God, every single Netflix series that's like based on a novel, it's the exact same story with slightly different characters, different location, a little different of a plot, but there's always going to be the misunderstood cop detective that sees something that others don't. And usually it's a minority cast, interestingly enough. And this is not, this is just an observation. There's always going to be like this dark, beautiful, hero, heroine who are really a villain, and we know they are because from the beginning, but you know, there's lots of fun. And then there's the new person who came to town who gets tangled in this web of deceit and lies, and like again and again and again. And there's very few series that will break that mold. So, okay, on the one hand, it's comforting to watch. We kind of know what's going to happen. There's a few little twists in the plot. But at the same time, I mean, it doesn't. So you have to use this structure for storytelling, but at the same time, let your originality, your creativity, your content shine through. And when I give you this framework, it frees you for it because it takes away the guesswork of the order of things. And it's all based, if you look into my framework, it's all investor questions or audience questions. That's the framework. Are you answering their questions, your audience's questions, in the right order? Very important.
So Donna, I'm not pattern match. So I think if we take a step back, a lot of founders come to the conversation with investors with this sort of mindset of, well, I have to convince them, I have to impress them, I have to mold myself into something that they would like. And I think there's obviously pattern matching that investors have that is valuable to know. And that sounds like you're laying out. But another kind of question is, well, what can you interrupt the pattern? And what is the value of interrupting the pattern? And where does it make sense to interrupt it, or where does it? Like, that's kind of the most important. Let's assume that you want to interrupt it somewhere, right?
Let's make a distinction between patterns and the human behind the startup and you know who you are as a founder. Okay, patterns are important because that's the way our brain takes in information and it's what they expect. And it's good. And we can only deal with like chunks of information. I write about the principle of chunking. That's why it's like four chunks, four acts of your investor deck. But again, that's the framework. I am thrilled when we can break through the patterns. There's a few different things I tell them. First of all, your origin story, because that's your own unique thing. Nobody can match that. Two, if you can give them a golden nugget, something they did not know about your market, about trends, about opportunities, about something that's happening, and you bring them a chunk of information that they didn't know, that moment, you will have won their respect and their like delight as well, because they hear so many pitches that suddenly you've got like this, wait a minute. And it's like this moment of crescendo. It's the twist. It's like, we're not the same. That's another thing. Two is also your differentiation. Truly, truly finding your place of differentiating. And that does not mean trouncing your competitors. It means being grateful that they exist and then building on their success to showcase what you're doing differently. So, I mean, you talked about different types of storytelling. There's so many different layers, but that there's like the elements of surprise is another bit of storytelling in it. Of trends, behavioral trends, like Gen Z are only looking for ethically sourced products and this gives us an edge. Or there's been a surge in digital health on the tail of COVID, and people now have changed the way they interact with doctors. So many different things. It could also be a golden nugget of something regulatory, a law that's about to change, something that they're going to need anyway, and you provide that solution ready to go. Or even find them something about heat in the market. One of your competitors who just raised a big round and you've gotten even farther than they have. That's like saying, take a look. You know? So there's so many different ways that we can do this and not make it your run of the mill pitch that all sound the same. So the framework becomes transparent. It's there, but all they're seeing, like, you don't see the frame of my house right now, right? You see walls and bookshelves and door and my books back there. Red lends a nice punch of color, but you don't see the framework, but it's there. We just don't give it any thought because it frees us from having to think, and then we can just decorate freely.
So and we'll probably, it's probably worth, as we discussed, it might be fun to do a real like spontaneous case study of how you work. But like, before we dive into that, one of the themes that's going to be relevant for anyone in the world who is concerned about AI, and you kind of you're quoted on saying, hey, you have to incorporate AI, you can't escape it, right? Like, you have it has to be part of the story. But at the same time, everybody's talking about AI and everybody's saying my AI is bigger than your AI. And
into AI fatigue for sure.
Yeah. And so in that world where, you know, AI is maybe just intelligent, right? Like, kind of another more simple word, applications of something used to be called automation. But in that world, when everybody's talking about it, how do you either make your story stand out, make it really concrete so people understand that what that does? Because that's something that almost changed in the last 2 to 3 years. I think 2 years ago, if you said, hey, I'm doing something with AI, that was good enough. And now I think it no longer is. So
yeah,
guide me on this curve, maybe the cycle of the story.
What's interesting is my book, I handed in my first draft in October 2022, like mid-October. And the last chapter is called The Future of Storytelling. And I wrote it with Jasper because OpenAI had not come out, ChatGPT hadn't come out. Yeah. And then 2 weeks later, or even a week later, GPT-3 was released. And my husband was like, hey, there's this new that you better check it out. And I was like, holy wow, I need to rewrite that last chapter with it. So I wrote this book at the very, 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 very early days of Gen AI coming out to the public. I mean, it's been around, but it hasn't been accessible. So what I did not there talk about your AI story and your AI moat, which I've become a big proponent of, and how you do it. So you cannot ignore it. So I've added a slide in to Act Two, which talks about your solution to introduce your AI defensibility or your AI moat. What truly makes you an everlasting company in the face of the OpenAIs and the Googles? Or what is your differentiation, or how will you incorporate it? Like, what is your unique AI story that's in there that shows, first of all, that you're thinking about it? Second of all, your unique use of AI. And for me, like, one of the best examples is health tech. I was just at a speech last week, half hour speech by this incredible guy, and he's a doctor and he's completely like entrenched in the whole AI for health tech. And he, you know, gave a 30-minute lecture, which probably should have been an hour, but squeezing it all in. But some incredible use cases for how AI can make things truly better for the human condition. And so it's finding that extra something of, okay, we know AI exists, but how are you using AI to better the world, to truly make an impact, to truly move the needle? And I think that's what's going to be the AI story. And I'm still learning as I go. I mean, this new things are emerging every day. And I mean, I have to think about my AI story as well. Because, I mean...
Am I talking to you, Donna, or is this someone?
Well, I have my deck check who's that. But yeah, people call me Donna GPT because I do process these messages in real time, which hopefully we'll do soon. But what's funny is, like, I mean, definitely I can't say that it hasn't impacted, because people have these great tools now to write their pitches for them. The problem is they all start sounding the same.
Oh my God. Yeah. So that's what really is scary, right? Like, and so kind of on that note, so I know we're going to, there's this sort of, the deck is part of the theater of startups, so to speak, and
it's still
necessary. But in the world where the deck could be produced at least visually in a decent way with some startups relatively quickly, what helps you? What do you need to do? What else do you need to do besides the deck? Right. Like, we'll come back maybe to the deck and the narrative, but like, Is it your physical presence when you're storytelling? Is it you making sure that you're getting on a calls and Zooms before the deck? What have you been advising in a very practical way?
So the physical presence always wins. Like when you can have a conversation, whether it's on Zoom or in person, it's a completely different.
So let's rate them, right? Like, so we're doing this.
But I can't tell people to do that because sometimes they're just like fill in this pre-screener where you upload your deck and we'll get back to you. So you can't always be there. At first, they're going to want to see the deck. They're going to want to hear something. So it's not always in your control.
But let's say it is, right? Like, let's say we are lucky few that have the choice of investors, and the investors that are going to make us fill out a questionnaire are probably like, maybe we'll just say that's not the right fit, or not, we didn't get to do our homework to get to them. So there's this in person, there's us talking right now, right? Mm-hmm. On Zoom, just to be clear, mm-hmm. if everybody's confused. So this is a Zoom. And you're amazing because I could see your body language, you're moving, you bring your furry props, you know, marvelously.
Who just left the room, yes.
Yeah, it's just so you're able to command presence in the Zoom environment. I think it's probably not an accident. I think a lot of us don't do that. Like I sometimes don't, you know, I don't think too much about it. I have my hands somewhere hidden.
Or someone might be listening to us as they're driving and not even looking at our images. So it's just our voice and our words that are doing the work. So it takes away one of the layers.
It takes away layers. So let's start ranking. Like, say 10 is perfect in person.
But are you going to be perfect in person? Like how many people don't use the
I showered today, Donna. I think this is
I'm just
that
so
time
happy.
Of the month, you know.
Yay. But you know what's funny? Do you want to take a guess? So I'm a communications coach at Stanford GSB. Going into my second year now, starting with them next week.
I almost want to go back and be coached by you. I want to go back to Stanford GSB.
No, somebody told me before I started at Stanford that the worst thing about GSB is you can only do it once.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What year did you graduate?
I don't want to say, I'm still learning.
You're still learning.
That it was the year when Steve Jobs was still alive and delivering his Stanford address. And it was pretty eye-opening.
Amazing. So Stanford's amazing. The community is amazing. Do you want to venture a guess what the number one reason, so they can all sign up and get half hour, 45 minute coaching session with me on whatever communication issue is plaguing them. Do you want to venture a guess? What was the most requested reason to meet with me last year? And it might be
insecurity about how you come across with your peers.
Part that might touch on it. But broaden that a little bit.
How to influence others.
Okay, it's going to be much more basic than that. And it's small talk, creating authentic small talk.
You go
to all these events, you have to introduce yourself, and then you have to kind of continue the conversation. And there you're getting stuck at the, how you doing, where you from.
Interesting.
So what I realized, and it was quite surprising to me at first, and then I started seeing, talk about pattern recognition, seeing it again and again. And then I realized most of these kids went to undergrad during COVID. So at least a chunk of their undergrad college experience was done online. Then the first few years of their career were done either remote or hybrid. And also, this is a generation that has grown up with a smartphone in their hand. These three factors together have taken away that spontaneous immersion in just communicating. And it's kind of, in a sense, crippled their ability to just interact and have a conversation, not to mention all these external influences of, oh my gosh, can I say that? Oh my gosh, am I gonna
Oh
offend
yeah,
anyone?
yeah. But
Oh my
especially
gosh, am I
places
gonna
like
trigger? I can't.
Stanford, where
That just
people,
occurred to me now that that's not a fourth element, and I'm not, you know, and I'm like, oh my gosh, if I had to kind of censor every single thing I'm saying, and we all do some, you know, do more than
Not on this
others
podcast. You can do
on this
whatever
podcast.
you
But
like.
I mean, if you're kind of screening everything you say, how can you possibly have a spontaneous, warm, wonderful conversation? And my number one piece of advice to them is get super curious about who you're speaking to. Ask them questions that are not just like the weather. You all at GSB right now have at least 10 shared experiences that have happened in the last week alone. You all took midterms. You all had Section Olympics. You all went to view from the top with the head of Sequoia. You all did this, and like these are all things that you all experience but might have a different perspective on. So ask, what did you think of the view from the top? Were you there? I was really inspired by when he said this. What was your greatest moment? And then he'll say something and be like, oh, you know, I missed that. And then it kind of starts to ping pong. But it's about listening. It's about truly getting curious about the other side and asking those questions that I think we've forgotten to ask because we're so caught up in our own little headspace that fits into Zoom.
Well, it's interesting. One thing you brought up is offering your own. So sharing something vulnerable or something that is kind of maybe taking a risk yourself to jumpstart things.
Yeah,
That
yes.
is
And
something that I'm still
self-monitoring.
learning. Like it's sort of it's an offer, and it signals to the other person that you could share something beyond the traditional social gambit, so to speak, that people use. Especially, this is particularly well known in Britain. There's just kind of certain things in that are just kind of safe from embarrassment, passive conversation,
I think that the
and
Brits
only
are
alcohol
both like
interrupts that.
critical and jealous of Americans at the same time, or at least historically, when I haven't been in England in a long time, but because it's like Americans just say whatever they want to say, not anymore. And there's like this like disdain, oh, so American. But at the same time, it's like I wish I could be, and now with everything happening in Britain with the censoring, it's just it's
Well,
a
yes, exactly. It was already censored in a weird way. Whereas I think what I find
It was
refreshing,
self-censored. It was
yes,
self-censored
this
for me.
self-censoring
Like,
there,
it's not polite to speak about that. Oh, you're so American.
Well, what I like about the French, which I think is the French, is that my wife is French, so I get to, is
Oh.
the it's necessary for them to disagree. It's like it's not about being disagreeable. It's I disagree, therefore I am. And so they there's this, and nobody takes it that personally up to a limit, of course. And so I protest, therefore I am, or I express my opinions. Yeah, I complain, therefore. So there's something about that. It may not always lead to positive direction. But at least it reduces the need to look perfect, the need and so I think that's another mode. But if we go back to another challenge in the sort of people communicating and having this initial social gambits, and then bring that to conversations when we're doing our pitches, dating. Right. So I think it looks to me, it feels like now I'm probably fortunate enough not to have been in the generation where I had
My God.
to do that. I had to learn the old fashioned way of meeting
I thought
people.
that, you
But
know, online website dating was tough. But I can't even remember. Imagine Tinder, Hinge, all these Bumble, everything. And oh my gosh,
So it
it's
becomes
brutal.
this very
By the way, people at
transactional.
GSB, towards the end of the semester, I did have communication conversations about dating. So I
I
find
love
that
them.
very endearing. And I'm like, oh, this is so complicated. This is so complicated.
It
Oh.
is life-changing, but it is. So we live in this world that worries me. Becomes very transactional. So like the dating is transactional because you're seeing thousands of people and you don't have time to be curious and connect. And then the fundraising, at least my perception from an investor perspective, maybe some founders, they're like, I'm just going to spray and pray every investor. We're going to chat GPT, auto play some emails and, you know, cover the earth type of strategy and getting connected. And it feels like a just a huge waste all around. So what is that? Is there something about that culture that we need to also break when we're trying to build that initial relationship? Is it the introduction that you have with a potential investor or a customer that really matters? Is it those first few minutes of that small talk? What allows you to get out of that? You're just a vendor to me, right? Like, I don't like there's like, and I hate this. The one thing I don't love about selling is just kind of like this people in large enterprises just kind of treat you as a vendor. And I'm like, I'm a human being. We're kind of bleeding this, right? I don't want to be thought of as a vendor. I don't want to think of you as a buyer. You know, I think you're somebody who wants to succeed at your work, etc. So we are in a world where spam has basically created, whether it's dating spam or B2B outreach spam, has created, or fundraising spam, has created a lot of this artificial and high volume interactions. And I'm curious, what are you finding besides storytelling that helps us break through that?
So are we talking in dating or are we talking with investor meetings?
Well, I think they're just, to me, they're what I'm trying to draw the parallel is, I think there's probably more similarities there than we realize, right? Like,
no, absolutely. And I use that's how I start my workshops off. Yeah, like if you think of the first investor meeting, like a first date. And yeah. I hope that on your first date, you're not talking about your entire dating history, where you'd like to be married, how many kids you want to have, like that kind of probably would be an insurance.
Here's why you should marry me.
You're not going to see that person again. And, you know, you might be sued for damages. And anyway, but it's the same thing with investors. So you have to kind of show your cards a bit at a time.
Okay.
And read the room. Kind of woo them in a sense. Don't throw all your Excels at them, your entire tech stack, all your financials for the next 10 years. I mean, you want to extract the meaning. You have the opportunity at the first meeting to control the narrative. Like, you do. If they ask you questions, that's great. That means that you've said something that's interesting enough to them that they want to ask you more. So don't get mad if they're asking questions. So don't throw it all there. Be very mindful and intentional. So you asked about types of storytelling. So the framework forces you to do that. It forces you to write from your audience's perspective. And that is the most important lesson that I can teach any founder. It's not about you. It's about them.
Mm.
It's not about you sounding important. It's not about you showing off your product. It's about you showing that you get your audience and you get the investor, and you're communicating to suit them. And when you, again, like I say to my Stanford students, get really curious, ask the right questions. It's the same thing when you prepare a pitch.
Mm.
Think of, what questions do you know for sure you'll be asked? Because everybody asks those. What questions do you think you might be asked? And what questions do you dread being asked? And think of the answers ahead of time, because there's nothing worse than going on every single question. You kind of have to be prepared for it. Now, I dedicated an entire chapter in my book to investor questions that you might get. So you have a reference point. And these questions, I mean, obviously they get a little bit more industry specific or time specific, but it's pretty much the same questions again and again and again. It's all about the other side. And this is like clicking coins and lights are popping in my brain right now, because you made me realize something else. It's not just about ready, getting curious and asking the question in the moment. It's about getting curious ahead of time. What do they really want to know?
Mm.
And when you write a speech or a paper or an article or anything from your audience's perspective,
right,
it completely changes the story. Completely. Mm. And you're engaging them, not yourself. If you want to laugh about your own jokes and your own running, great, do it in your own space. But if you actually want somebody to read it and get it and get excited about it and want to meet you, want to go on that date, not just look at your dating profile, which is, I guess, your pitch deck. then think about them.
That's a beautiful, beautiful metaphor. I think one of the things that, as I said, kind of got me fired up about starting this crazy project was related to first as almost as an agency was the idea that I was too much obsessed with my ideas and how smart they were, and not enough was kind of how the audience will be able to receive them and act on them. And so I wanted to help fix that with the technology. And I think as we were riffing a little bit before the call, Donna, you've offered a chance to apply your framework on how do we tell the relate to story better. And I am very humble because I think we are in the storytelling business, so we need to be much better at this than we are right now. I think we've been, you know, despite being storytellers, we've been very much product centric organization, kind of eating, breathing, using our own. I don't want to use the word dog fooding. I think
eating, I have something better.
Eating caviar.
Drinking your own champagne. Champagne.
Yeah,
so much
champagne
sexier
and caviar.
Than eating your,
exactly. Yeah. Like
was
a
dog food. Come
was
on.
A candle. Yeah. Was a candle
okay.
setting. So
we can
so
tell the Russian
it.
Boots caviar. Yeah. So yeah, caviar. Between you being Russian and your wife being French, so are you eating caviar on croissants right now? I'm
caviar
sure.
Was maybe champagne just for
bon
flash.
And you sip on champagne from the Champagne region. Oh, your house is just so magnifique.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So disclaimer here.
Okay.
Alex and I have had one conversation. I feel like, you know, at those magic shows we've never met before. I know, you know, very, very little about Relate To. And I told Alex that because I'm Donna GPT, one of the things I love to do most is to listen to a pitch and then ask some questions and then just do what I call a pitch back. Say, okay, here's how I tell your story. So we have not planned this. I always pray.
I didn't even know that you were going to ask for a pitch, but that's so
no,
we
it
really
could be a pitch or it could be just telling me how you're telling your story in the way you're doing it now. And then I process it through my LLM. My brain is an LLM.
Okay.
And I always pray to like the muses of storytelling and the gods of OpenAI who have granted me this LLM or whoever, please be with me and not have a system fail. And I don't know. I mean, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
So that's my disclaimer. So having said that, if you want to play, let's do it.
I love it. I love it. I think nothing keeps you alert than a real conversation. And
I do these a lot, by the way. I'll do like online communities where they'll sign up for a pitch back and they have like 2-3 minutes to pitch, and then I go, here's how I tell your story. Yes,
let's
so
do
go
it.
For it.
So I'll tell you roughly what feels very comfortable to me, and I think the as a human story, and then I'll connect the dots to the business. So. Relate To feels like a lifelong mission for me because my very first internship was at Microsoft Office team. At the time when Microsoft had this beautiful Clippy, which was kind of animated thing, and it had
Clippy.
You know, we had all these animations naturally, and we were the good guys. Actually, we were the good guys back. It was kind of before it was sort of Google that was kind of
emerging.
You
were the good guys, or you were the cool, were you ever the cool guys?
I thought we were cool because I came from Soviet Union, and so for Soviet Union, you know, with the dark empire,
it's like I like to think that I'm cool.
It was cool because it was democratizing communications, and we were refugees, we were like oppressed, so it was like it was the good thing. I'm not judging anything, but it was like mentally I was proud of us being there. We were building this beautiful way to create the first no code Excel is a no code spreadsheet, you know, solution. PowerPoint was no code, create no design creativity, and it was a lot of fun. And my project as a product manager was to look at this thing called the PDF and understand why it's taking over our beautiful creations in the last mile when it was kind of being downloaded online or being sent over to the customer. People were freezing their Word and PowerPoint files into this format. And then, you know, that was basically analog piece of paper. And then throughout the rest of the career, I kind of, since we haven't figured out at Microsoft how to do it, I was just kind of like always paying attention and consulting. You know, you do all this work and it ends up being dusty in print or dusty in a PDF somewhere. And then I was very fortunate to join SaaS pioneers like Salesforce and SuccessFactors that were, you know, we really redefined a new category. It was challenging. It was exciting, but we were selling SaaS, better employee experience, better customer experience on a piece of paper, really a virtual piece of paper, still like not connected to what we were selling. And, you know, when we launched content businesses, they were a bunch of PDFs. And so that was sort of another thing that bothered me. And I knew better. I knew, like, at Stanford, I took a class on how to make ideas stick. And I knew that there's something else there. There's scientific approaches to storytelling, to better communication. So at some point, I was fortunate enough where I could pick and choose some projects. And one of the things that drew me is working almost as an agency at first with Salesforce, with Accenture, with Omnicom Group, on helping them take their PowerPoints, improve the messaging, but also improve the format. And so we started turning PowerPoints into sites because everything changed except for the PDF. And like particularly the website from the era when I was at Microsoft to today is unrecognizable. But you look at a PDF from, you know, 20 years ago to today, you know, roughly the same. And so we sort of started doing that. And one thing led to another. And, you know, customers loved it. They told us what great looks like. And we productized it, and that became, was AI, that became Relate to AI, where anybody can go and, you know, drag and drop any type of content, PDFs, PowerPoints, videos, links, you know, text, and it creates two products. One is an interactive site, for example, what most PDF is now a website, and the second product is a Netflix-style portal that, unlike Netflix, doesn't just contain videos, but could contain any content and create an extended narrative and a destination for your audience to accomplish something. And so that's the backstory and what so really motivates
a landing page, a website, a content portal. What would you call it?
Yes, yes, yes. Like, so I think, it's like that's part of the challenge. I would say that it's been easiest to show what it does versus
absolutely. That's a definite. Just, let's talk in a minute about the visual aspect and why that's
but important. Yeah. So basically, we take a static document and turn it into all singing, all dancing website, to use your earlier metaphor about you know, Broadway.
And it's taking the content and automatically generating this thing. So I could take something that I've written and it completely transforms it into a site without me doing anything design.
Without you doing anything. But the one thing that we found is the sweet spot, and that this is for what we've learned, is when we launched the product, like we were working with these high-tech enterprise customers, mm-hmm. and some of them were also in regulated industries. And what we noticed is they don't want it to completely transform because it's risky, because it took a long time to put it together, to approve it, to get the messaging right, to get the visuals to approve. So they want to transform it from a static experience that's designed for print, not for screen, into a screen-friendly experience, but without altering the meaning. And that's became our big aha, that in a lot of these overlooked regulated industries, insurance, health communications, financial services, government, you know, communications, the risk of, you know, ChatGPT unleashed is very, very high. So you need to create something that's consumable, which is a big burden for these industries, but at the same time, compliant. And so that's the sweet spot. So we call it regenerative AI we're building, because it sort of does not generate it completely for search, but it regenerates it along the approved guardrails to create a non-brand compliant experience for that, for the users.
So let's connect the dots a little bit. So you talked about, you know, being at Microsoft and working on Clippy and democratizing it, and then pondering within that why the PDF was taking over and why it has sustained. Why was it you were fascinated by the PDF of all things?
Well, we were worried that we are not, we do all this work on the creative side, but at the moment of truth, when customer interacts with the ideas that were created in Microsoft tools, we are not there. And so we don't know what happens with those ideas. We don't control it. We let it over to Adobe, which was, you know, at the time owned the PDF format before, but it ultimately became de facto standard. There is no feedback loop. So those were some of the thoughts that were, you know, a concern, because we're basically letting go of the most important last mile in the content creation to communication value chain.
So you feel that after they were leaving Word or PowerPoint and taking it to PDF, that it entered a black box and you had no idea where it
It's a
went,
black box, yeah. And it still is. For
And you
us,
wanted the data. You wanted, like, why didn't Microsoft create like a way to create an uneditable version? I guess there's read only, but why
they
instead of
tried? I think they tried. I think they was just they kind of missed it. They weren't as focused. They PDF was able to support other formats, other than just Microsoft, right? So it was more universal. So it could be a you know, InDesign file becomes a PDF, right? Like, so other outputs. So it was, and the sort of, in a way, when we think about relate to, we're not killing PowerPoint or Word. We're not killing PDF even, right? We're taking PDF in whatever varieties it is, plus any other formats, and we're giving them the last mile touch for the modern consumer.
So the
Right.
last mile. So, but I'm confused as
Yes.
to how that relates to the PDF. So that's where you've kind of stumped me. And I'm thinking, if you're creating this thing where you've put guardrails in place, but it transforms it into living, breathing data that is fun and engaging to look through, why is this like the new PDF that you're looking at? Something that's there but can be transformed, something that you own the data of interaction, of how people are looking at it and what they're reading. And is this like the living, breathing PDF? What are we looking at here?
Yeah,
Why
I think that's one way I think one way to think of it is, here's a document and here's a website, or like a AI and chat. Sorry, my hands are not on the screen. So one is document, one is kind of modern AI powered website. And
But
we're married.
Isn't the bigger pain the daunting thought of creating a website? And then Wix has, you know, semi-solved that and made it easy to create a
That's right.
codeless website, just plug and play. And then those all kind of look the same. So what's the difference with Relate to?
Yes. So I think when you think of an average B2B person, that's like even the B2B marketer, like a product marketer, they don't have either the permission to create Wix or the platforms within their organizations. And then when you go lay even beyond the marketer to kind of the sellers and so on, like, do you want sellers to go figure out how to use Wix, build custom Wix website, even if they're easy? No, but they all have templates, and they all have, for example, like in insurance, you all have approved documents that you get from, if you're a broker that's delivering insurance, you actually don't even have control over the product. It's a PDF that you get from your insurance carrier that you deliver to your customer, and you pick the right one and bring it to them. So we feel that in the regulated industries, not only are you like having the types of people that will never go and even use the simplest of no code or vibe coding tools, but you also have,
I don't think they called it vibe coding back in the time of Wix.
Yeah,
That's pretty new.
But like even the new ones, but more importantly, the coin of the realm is the document. But yet every document wants to be, for it to be consumed, it needs to be turned into something more consumable. So we're marrying the simplicity and the universality of a document with the power of an interactive web-like experience. And then that is the sweet spot. So it's not that we're trying to replace Wix or your corporate content management systems. We're creating for these niche use cases where neither Wix nor corporate content management systems are really working today. You could
and is
enable,
it because of regulation that they're not working?
We've seen it in enterprises that are not even deeply regulated, but it certainly is just the I think the main reason there's skills in actually creating custom mm-hmm. true custom experience that's complex. Wix is great for simple things like your mm-hmm. band site or like a simple kind of personal website. It's much harder when you have like a 200 page annual report to kind of try to create that was
so you want to transform the experience of reading this dense annual
yes.
report that nobody actually reads into this guided, immersive, beautiful experience
beautiful that's
where
right
people live it. It's almost, I imagine it like, you know, those living museums that you live in where you can, you know, touch a wall
yes
and something comes
yeah
up.
the video pops up or there's a non-linear
It's
navigation. You
almost
don't
like
have
a
to go.
museum, a gallery,
Yes.
a live immersive gallery of
One way of
knowledge.
thinking about it. Exactly. And I think
Okay.
there's a balance, right? That you could go in some cases, you could go very advanced. In some cases, even basic things like adding navigation and immersive videos and the, you know, like really smart,
And you
you
guys
know,
can
converse.
automatically do
And
that,
we do
pull
that
up.
in like 30 seconds. So
Okay,
30
so let me
seconds,
ask you
you
a
get.
question. What was the pain point that you really saw? And the whole Microsoft team and everything is amusing, but I don't think that that's the real origin story. Sometimes we have to dig a little bit deeper to find it. What was that point in time that if you can think back and remember, oh my gosh, we can do so much better?
I think because I was a former consultant, when I was at SuccessFactors, we, and I kind of oftentimes wore product marketing hat, competitive hat. And so I was basically enabling the entire, you know, sales organization, go-to-market organization with some of the content or I or my team.
Okay. Shiny
And
binders, right?
yeah. And so and I think I took what PowerPoint could do to a max.
Yeah. Yeah,
And but
yeah,
it
yeah.
was
Okay,
still a
there's the
PowerPoint.
pain. There's the pain. Now I'm feeling that that's the story. And that's something that we can all identify with. It starts to see my hand doing that. It's like the story starts to beat. And that's where I would start. And I would say, you know, being part of the consulting world, and before that in Microsoft, we have been obsessed with the dissemination of knowledge, of content, of data, of the form factors ranging from a PowerPoint to a shiny binder that we'd left behind that usually ends up collecting dust. And even if we give it to them on a PDF, nobody is reading 200 page reports. They may skim it, they may scan it, and even PDFs, which are still have been used for so long, nobody's reading these. And yet we're told to write them. And yet we spend hours and hours and hours and days and weeks and months poring over creating this content that basically people might read 6% of. And usually they'll glimpse at the headlines, maybe drill down in what's relevant to them. And maybe what's relevant to me would be different to my coworker over here who's working on something completely different. And that, if it could leap out to him, would be the changing point for him. And relate to has completely changed the way we interact with knowledge, data, and content. We take the content, we take the research, we take the knowledge that there is to be disseminated and transform it into an interactive, immersive experience that knows you, the consumer, and knows how to surface the most important, most engaging bits of information and transform it into videos, into images, into memes. I'm making this up. I don't know if you guys have memes there, but and in a way that you experience that content consumption in a completely personalized, interactive, almost fun, just like scrolling your socials doesn't seem like a task. It's the same. You're scrolling this content and stopping at the bits that jump out to you. So it's time to break out of the slide. It's time to break out of the doc. It's time to break out of the PDF or even just the basic scroll website and create a new form factor of consuming data. I don't know if that
Yeah, it's
hit.
great. I think we always struggle in this narrative between the value we provide for the creator and the value for the consumer, because those are, like, if you could imagine, these are our two stakeholders. So for the consumer, you know, this is, you've kind of, it's you've kind of really finished with a strong consumer. And then the only thing is, like, as we move into the product, is for the creator, it's like what I was saying is, like, well, to build a custom website, or even if it's scrollable and whatnot, is like a big
Okay,
lift.
so there's
Yeah.
another pain here. The question is who? Okay, so let's rejigger that a little bit. And if we want to look at it from the perspective of the creator, it's, we're writing this, we're pouring our blood, sweat, and tears, but just because I know how to write content or do the research doesn't mean I know how to make it look pretty, how to make it interactive, how to build a website. And a lot of organizations have problems with Wix or any of these Squarespace and building these small websites because it doesn't align with their corporate policies. So let's say we wanted to transform it, too much work, too much time. And that's where we come in. So you want to add that layer in. And that's speaking to the two different sides of
Do
the
the different
problem.
sides. Yes. I
And
think
people
with
ask,
that, I feel like that's great.
what should you focus on? And usually when you focus on the pain, you focus on the pain of the person who's paying the bill at the end. But at the same time, the real pain is the end user. So it's a B2B2C or a B2B2B play.
Yes, and so this is sort of related. So, what, maybe you have some tips on how to tackle this. So, I mentioned that we're shifting from a relatively like, it's a horizontal pain. Like in most B2B organizations, this is universal. But what we found is that in regulated industries, the pain is more visceral, because they're the people in the consumer side. They're, you know, all consuming TikToks and short form factor, but and then they're forced to, like, this boring regulated materials that are hard to digest. And so when you come to one of our use cases, is employee benefit advisors and brokers are basically an outsourced HR function in most organizations, like from 50 to 2,000 employees, that delivers your benefits, which is 25% of employee cost to a company, and a huge reason whether you could go bankrupt or not if you have the right health insurance. And nobody understands this stuff. And they're paying money for it. Companies are paying money for it. And
And they don't
it's
know
it, it
why.
and let's say HR. Like, I mean, think of this, like, if marketers are struggling with this in some organizations, can you imagine HR team? They're really struggling. Like, they don't know, they can't get an agency, they don't know where agencies live. They And so, and yet, this is like the ultimate B2B to C purchase. This is like the equivalent of multiple houses that you buy in the t in your lifetime that people are making, right? Like, this is the single biggest financial decisions one often makes, as a, in the US at least. And so that's the tragedy that we see, and that's kind of one of the things that these benefit brokers found us. We weren't even looking for them. They said, hey, we have this problem. Like, we can't create these massive sites, you know, with our resources, with our time, with our tax season equivalent when everybody does open enrollment at the same time. So that's kind of a live example of how it gets used. And I would say I struggle, Donna, like, explaining the big vision, the kind of the big opportunity that kind of everybody could get excited about getting our most important ideas out there. And then this sort of very specific, very powerful use case that, you know, people could relate to, of like spending 25% of your compensation on stuff you don't understand and feeling like it's going to
Absolutely.
waste.
Absolutely.
How would
Look,
you deal with that?
first of all, let's go back to what you said about the visual, okay? Seeing is believing in your case. I feel like I'm missing a huge part of the picture. So when you have something that's visual in your startup, it's highly visual, you must start with that as soon as possible. powerful demo, a walkthrough, a screen capture of before I tell you, let me show you. And we're going to have to start wrapping up, because in about 5 minutes, I have another, I just realized we've been talking for a while and I have another coaching session coming up. But here's the thing. The last time our brains got a hardware upgrade was 36,000 years ago. I'm not talking about software. We get software upgrades daily, all the time. Hardware upgrade, our prefrontal cortex was born. And it's the largest processing center of our brain. And it's also responsible for visuals. And it, the first thing it allowed us to do was to stop killing members of our own tribe because we could recognize them. So we need that visual. Now, Steve Jobs, speaking of Steve Jobs, who you brought up before, when he stood up and showed the iPad, like a Simba moment, it was like, oh, okay, I get it. It's like a really big smartphone, or somebody tore their computer in half. And so great, now I can just go back to listening. Sometimes we just need to see it and then go back and understand why it is and what it works. So for you, if you were my client, I'd say, start off, introduce yourself and say, but before I tell you any more, I want to show you something, and do like a 30-second walkthrough of a very dense paper, and like just, and, you know, and how it relates. Just show, this is a typical report that McKinsey produces. You've seen it before, doc, doc, doc. And now look at it through the lens of Rileto and show off some of like the cool features. Now, I wouldn't do this all the time. Just remember you asked me about how you would break through and do something different. This would definitely be different. I'm breaking my own mold. And this is what over however many users, customers you have are experiencing, and over however many people have viewed Rileto's are consuming. It's a revolution in content consumption. Okay, now that you've seen it, let me backtrack a little bit and go back, and then you decide your origin story. But you've shown them, you've wowed them, you've hopefully dropped their jaws.
And would it be consumption or going from a PDF, show them like, hey,
how I'm consuming content in a completely different way than I would in a PDF. I'm living it.
Right. Okay. So you don't need to show the transformation. You just need to show the actual.
Well, you can show, okay, just scroll through a PDF. Blah, blah. We all know what that looks like. Now,
yeah.
Imagine what's on those pages leaped out to meet you.
Yeah. Beautiful. I love how you had a dramatic pause. There's a revolution. That was beautiful.
Yeah, it's important.
Any other tips, Donna, that, you know, maybe not for us, but like through this experience that you kind of picked up, or something that other founders should be thinking about?
So many, but I mean, it really would take more of a deeper dive to go in. I need to see the product.
You need to see the product. Right. Got it.
And that's usually the first thing I'll ask startups to do is show me, walk me through the product. And show me as a user perspective how I would build one and then how I would consume one. Because here it's two sides.
Two separate sides.
Yeah. Amazing. You're the creator and then there's the consumer. Different people, different pains, different needs.
Donna, this has been amazing. I think people are lining up to learn about your method. How can they find you, and how can you help your storytellers?
I make it very easy to find me, donnagriffith.com, 2 F's. 1 T, there's a story there. It's not Griffith or Griffin. So that often confuses it. That's where I am. And also I'm going to put, you can add to the show notes, the deck check, which is it deckcheck@donnagriffith.com. And this is my AI version of myself that will help you you can upload your investor deck there. It's free. The back end is OpenAI, but it's my own, you know, pro. So it's not like out there as much as anything cannot be out there in the era of AI. And we know that. So it gives you a score and then tips to improve it. I have people like that'll keep coming back and like trying, they'll make improvements and then upload it. The score goes up a little, then it goes down a little, then it goes up. So they're constantly playing with it. So feel free to play. My book is another option. I'm personally partial to audiobooks. So I recorded an audiobook in my voice. So if you're driving in traffic, we can spend a few hours together talking about it. And those are the main ways. So website, deck check, book, and please do mention Alex's show and relate to so that I know that's where you came from, you will have a special discount as a listener. So
Amazing.
yeah.
Thank you so much, Donna. What a great
Thank you.
masterclass in storytelling. Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relate2.com, RELYTO.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relate2.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.